So here's the first question. One of the reasons why I was not here this morning is because I just came from an unveiling. And one of the things we were talking about as we were gathered around preparing and waiting for the rest of the family to come is the unbelievability of absence. That is, someone's there and then they're gone. And it's impossible to wrap your mind around the fact that the person is gone. And even a year later at the unveiling, the family members couldn't quite, they would still pick up the phone, not believing that this person was actually gone. So I want to ask how you cope, I don't know, whether intellectually, emotionally, how do you come to terms with the reality of absence in life? And I know that's a very open-ended question, but I'm happy to, please, Anne.
Well, in essence, this is what my workshop was about.
Okay, so
because people are gone, but they're not gone. And so so much of the work of grieving is about being able to shift our identification with them to really recognizing that we can communicate with the soul, but we have to go through that horrible, really, really excruciating experience of letting go of their physical presence. But there's great comfort and great potential in an ongoing relationship once we can surrender that and have that sense of soul connections. They really do. I think that's what it means, is may someone's memory become a blessing, because it means that you can think of them, you can feel their presence, and you haven't truly lost them.
Anyone?
Please, Robert. You know, when I think about that, picking up the phone, thinking that they're there, there's a distinction, as I mentioned earlier, between what the ego self, the ego mind knows, the person has died, and it seems that the soul lives on another plane of existence sometimes, where the soul, as Rabbi Wolpe so eloquently said, just really can't metabolize the idea of a person being absent. So even though the ego mind knows, maybe in a wretched way, that the person has died, the soul continues to hope. And one of the definitions of hope is hope is an emotional articulation of a belief that things will change, that something's going to be different. Now, to grieve well, you have to know when a person dies, they're gone. But the soul continues to hope. And I think in grieving well, one doesn't try to repress the knowledge of the soul. One simply, in my mind, has to speak to the soul. Not just speak to the deceased, but speak to the soul. And understand that there's something in the soul, in its own hopefully obstinate way, that says they're not gone. And I don't recommend repressing that. What I recommend is being in conversation with it.
I would just add something that people may have heard me say at a Shiva Minyan, is to not speak about the people who have passed in terms of their qualities, but to tell their stories. That's, I think, one of the most ultimately Jewish things that we do. If you look at our Torah, it's not a list of characteristics of Abraham or a list of characteristics of Joseph, but it talks about their lives in terms of how they lived, how their stories were told. And those were the stories that were told and retold, and that's how we have them today. And that's how people are remembered, by the stories that we tell and retell. We're never going to remember every single detail about a person's life, every single event that happened, but certain moments will stick out because they were indicative of their character. And I always recommend to people to always be telling and retelling those stories, even sometimes when they're sad and when they're painful. But those are the ways that they continue to live on, especially for the next generations. One of the most powerful experiences I had in rabbinical school was having a teacher who would speak about these ancient rabbis from the Middle Ages or from the Talmud, and the way he spoke about them was as if they were still there in the room and he could dialogue with them. He'd never met them, but he was able to get in touch with them through the study of texts. And how much the more so for people that we already knew, and that we're so intimate in our lives, that we can still be in dialogue with them by telling and retelling their stories.
Dr. Thomas, how do parents, I'm going to start with you on this one, how do parents prepare children or teens for the death of a loved one?
Well, what we do in palliative medicine, again, is in my little workshop, we talked about having an interdisciplinary team that helps prepare. So we actually have child life specialists, psychologists, who help kids depending on their developmental age in appropriate ways. For example, little kids, you may need to do play therapy because they don't have the words to talk about the fear, the anger that they have, and so you need to have let them have another way to vent that. Oftentimes, parents want to protect their kids from the truth, but actually sometimes that can be the worst thing because kids know. And so oftentimes what the palliative medicine team, again, that's a healthcare team that can help a family by facilitating a conversation where they can, in a gentle way, let the kids know the truth and reality and let them feel safe to respond in appropriate ways. So rather than avoiding the issue, which is often the way I need to protect my child, it actually is oftentimes best to confront it, but in an appropriate way and with appropriate healthcare providers that can be facilitated in an optimal way.
I'm going to actually combine, if you don't mind, I'm going to take the moderator's privilege of combining an answer to two questions. The next question is, I have a serious and chronic illness that makes me face death every few weeks for over 25 years. What is God trying to teach me, and if I learn it, will I get well? I'm going to combine that and the last question, because as somebody who's had a couple of health crises and is in remission from lymphoma, the truth is that I know eventually the kind of lymphoma I have comes back. So one of the things that I had to do was to decide what to tell our daughter. And what Dr. Thomas said, which I want to highlight, is that the one thing you don't want to do is tell your child something that they will discover later is a lie. So you don't want to say, yes, I'm cured, I'm fine. Because when the time comes that the child discovers that you lied, you've ruined your credibility for later truths that you might need to tell them. Like, yes, it's true, it's come back, but we can be treated. Well, why should I believe that? Because you told me it was never going to come back. So remember that you're not only answering the question for the moment. You're answering the question for all the other times you will have to answer your children's questions. And if you've destroyed your credibility by not telling them the truth, then you've undermined a great deal more than they're needing to face the truths of life, because sooner or later they will discover that loved ones die. And so over-shielding them from it may be doing a disservice. If they ask, or you ask, or anyone asks, what's God trying to teach me through illness, I'm going to let the other rabbis answer that first, but I have very strong feelings about what God's trying to teach you through illness. So,
well, I mentioned earlier that I personally, now I'm not counseling someone else, I'll tell my personal opinion, I just object to that whole notion. I think illness is one of those random things that happen, sometimes random, sometimes we bring some things on because of unhealthy living. Sometimes random things that happen to us in the universe. The body is weak and frail. The universe is broken, weak, and frail. And I don't think God is teaching us by giving us an illness. What I think what happens is, as one faces illness and one looks to be spiritually strong and to seek the right kind of a therapy, that one is bringing down, number one, strength from the divine. One is trying to find wisdom from the divine to deal with it and to work with other people. So when a person says, what is God trying to teach me? I don't think God is trying to teach us through the illness. You have to tap into God's teaching to face the illness and to work with other people.
Well, it's such an important question. And as many of you know, I also have just come through a serious illness, which has a great likelihood of recurring. One of the phrases that really sticks with me is the phrase that we use on Yom Kippur and is often misremembered. We say tzedakah, tefillah, and teshuvah, and people want to say that it averts the severe decree, as if you do it enough, there'll be no bad things happening. What in fact it is it averts the severity of the decree, which means, I think, that if we live a life in which we're centered on holiness, where we really identify with ourselves as souls, then we have the opportunity to view things in a very different way than if we're only identified with our bodies. And by really developing spiritual practices, by having the sense of ourselves as spiritual beings, I think that we come to terms with things and we understand life in a way that can be a really valuable teaching. I would never, ever think that any of us has been singled out to be taught something by God. I just don't experience holiness in that way. But I do think that we all merit greatly when we are aware that we are not just physical beings and us really focus on I mean, what we're doing today, it says in the Talmud, he who focuses on death, who explores death, improves himself. Or she improves herself. Doesn't say that, but that's what it means. I think that by being here and by looking even at the title of our conference, of the conference, we are really doing the work of trying to learn what we need to learn in order to be human.
I would just add, I don't think that there is inherent meaning in suffering. But I do think that people can make meaning out of suffering. I think you wrote a book called that. I haven't read it yet, I'm sorry. Still waking my way through why faith matters.
It's okay.
But I think that's something we all inherently understand. People are confronted by these terrible conditions, and we should never be so prideful to say, oh, look what you can learn from it. If they want to, someone can make meaning. And I think we know a lot of people who have suffered tragedy and have been able to use that as an insight to the greater world that there is. I think if someone were to write a book now, they shouldn't title it "When Bad Things Happen to Good People," but they should title it "Bad Things Happen to Good People." It's something that happens. The question is, how do we respond to it? And I think Rabbi Finley already addressed that topic very beautifully. And as an individual, I think once we are not confronted necessarily with the immediacy of the crisis, we are able to use those spiritual resources to make meaning and to make the world a little bit better.
I agree. Well, the only thing that I'll add is that the reason in part that we have this idea is not only because much of the Jewish liturgy supports it, even though you've just heard four rabbis contradict it, but also because it is easier to feel guilty than it is to feel helpless. If you're guilty, tomorrow you can be innocent. It's true, I did bad things, but tomorrow I'm going to do good things and then I'll be okay. But the truth, as you all know, is that we aren't guilty as much as we are helpless. You can be the best person in the world and die young of a terrible disease. You can be a miserable SOB and live a long, healthy life. And that means that we can't control it. But we can't give up the feeling that we can control it because it's too frightening. So I don't know about you, but when I look in the obituaries, I want to make sure that that person died of something or did something that has nothing to do with me. Ah, well, I see. He went to the Amazon and contracted a rare disease. But I'm not going to the Amazon, exactly. Fool, he went to the Amazon. I mean, now why do we do that? Because we want to believe that we have control. But and to give up control is frightening for us and even more frightening when we think about it in terms of our children. So we surround them with everything, you know, from bumpers on the furniture to prohibitions, and we say, now you're going to be safe. But the reality is that only a certain percentage is in our control, and lots of it isn't. So there it is. I mean, I don't know what to say. And I feel a compulsion in this part of the same thing to draw some lesson from that's positive. And the truth is, the only lesson I can draw from that is if you integrate the fragility of life, you also integrate its value. That is, you don't live as if you have forever, because you know that you don't. But it's a very painful realization to know that you don't have forever. So until you're in some way forced to that realization, most people tend not to have it, which is why it's very hard for someone who's older to talk to someone who's younger and try to convince them that, in fact, at 18, one day you will die, because it seems so unreal that unless the person's been sick and they don't have to integrate it, they don't, because why shatter your faith in the world before you have to? It's just that eventually all of us have to, and then you start rebuilding, and you rebuild in a different way. Which I guess is part of this question. How do you deal with families who refuse to acknowledge the imminent death of a loved one? Doctor, I'll start with you again. How do you deal with those families?
Well, oftentimes we'll work through the patient first. We'll actually have a family meeting where the patient can be present, the family can be present, and we'll actually ask patients, you know, what they understand about the situation, what they're hoping for. And oftentimes that gives their loved ones a chance to acknowledge their inability to accept that their loved one is dying. If their loved one no longer has decision-making capacity, is no longer conscious, that's another level of difficulty trying to deal with things. But what I typically try to do is take people back to when they can remember times where they did talk to their loved one and ask them about what their loved one's values and goals were. Sometimes, again, when it can be a crisis type thing in the intensive care unit where a loved one may need to go on a ventilator or come off of a ventilator, and that has other ethical issues associated with it. But oftentimes family members don't want to deal with it because they don't want to feel guilty like they unplugged their loved one. But what we often try to do is take them back to a point where they may have had a conversation in the past, and they're just, and that's, in that case, they can just spit back, in a sense, like a tape recorder, what their loved one had said about a particular situation clinically. And therefore, they're actually not deciding life or death for their loved one that was causing them to go into denial. They can just say, these are the express wishes. I recall it. I'm just carrying out their wishes. It's not me needing to feel guilty about something. And so those various techniques just draw out what the values and goals of the patient are, the family unit are, usually can help people kind of come to grips with the situation. So most of the time, loved ones really want what's best, and we think sometimes maintaining the body may be what is best, but when you actually think through and can get some scientific data about the situation or get some life experience about other people who've gone through that process before, it can make things easier to accept.
Okay. I'll just add also that sometimes you want people to realize things just because you think they should. If it doesn't actually make a difference, and some people feel much more protected by being in denial, don't assume that it must be terrible just because it would be terrible for you. The person will die eventually, and they will have to cope with it, but different people have different mechanisms and different social, cultural traditions, and you don't always have to force someone to a realization that they're not ready for. This is something that we have a tendency to do just because we want them to be on the same wavelength that we are, but people have different ways of looking at the world. So there also is a certain, you have to, unless there are decisions that need to be made, we also have to have a certain humility about the way we look at the world and know that it isn't necessarily the right way for everyone. This is an interesting question. I'd like actually everybody's take on this. The question of what used to be called the Hemlock Society, and I didn't know that they changed their name, but that's smart. they're now called Compassion and Choices, about essentially giving people the right to end their own life. They give you various options about ways in which you can end your life. And how do you feel about, I get calls, as I'm sure you all do, about the question of whether someone should end their life or you should help someone end their life. How do you make these decisions? Why don't we start, Rabbi Finley, with you, and then we'll go to Rabbi Brenner, Rabbi Sella, Dr. Thomas.
When I think about a question such as that, I go back to something I just taught in the workshop, which is when I'm faced with the true life situation as opposed to the statute. You know, sometimes in Jewish law, the statute says one thing. You look up at the case law of how an individual rabbi may have adjudicated a decision. It's very different from how the same rabbi might have written a statute. So statutorily, it's against the Jewish religion to take one's own life too early. There's a moment when the beginning of organ shut down, the person has lost quality of life and so forth. There are things that some rabbis permit to not impede an inevitable death. But in general, the tradition is against a person taking his or her life when, let's say, they have, you know, weeks or months to live in general. And then I come to, you know, the awful sense of the case present to you. Let's say a person has some kind of an illness where they know that their body's going to become absolutely paralyzed, but they will be conscious inside a paralyzed body, completely trapped in the prison of their body. And they've come to you for counsel, and they say, I might live a long time with my mind alert and my body, including my eyelids and my eyeballs, completely mobilized. I'll have no contact with the outside world, and the specter of that absolutely horrifies me. And my quality of life has completely disappeared because I'm in such terror of that inevitable fate. I can't tell you what I would say. But I can tell you that when I'm faced with that kind of situation, I have to read myself, read that person, read the tradition, and hopefully say what is the truest and most honest thing for that person.
There's so many different ways of really looking at this issue. I have known people who were in situations such as the one that Rabbi Finley just described, for whom it was absolutely intolerable. And I've known people who'd been able to make a transition and really identify themselves as a soul and actually make peace with the fact that they no longer really had a body and live a life that had a great deal of meaning to them. I worry in our culture that once we begin making it possible for people to let go on their own, that issues such as, well, Medicare no longer helps me, and it becomes a financial issue and not a medical issue or an issue having to do with pain. And so it's a very fragile edge. And so I, as with any situation, one is really present to whatever is there and what's the right thing. But there's so many different ways of looking at it and so many things to be cognizant of.
I would just also add that there are a lot of cases, I think, where people would like to end their lives and they haven't received the enough mental health care or palliative care, and those issues are very present in their lives, and if their larger life situation was different, they might think differently about it. On the other hand, there are some terrible diseases where people are not depressed and they're not necessarily in pain, and they just know they're going to die. The issue that keeps me up at night, knowing what Rabbi Finley stated about the kind of what's on the books in terms of Jewish law, is the case of people with Lou Gehrig's disease, where they know their body's slowly going to be paralyzed from the legs up, and they're going to die a slow, suffocating death, and we have nothing. We have no way of stopping it. We have no way of preventing that other than of killing them or letting them do something before they really have lost complete control of their arms to kill themselves. And we haven't yet come up, I don't think, with a good medical solution or necessarily a good halachic solution to people suffering in that situation or in similar situations.
I guess part of the assumption underlying people wanting to kill themselves is often that there's going to be horrible physical suffering. And fortunately, in the modern day of medicine, we can really typically pretty much eradicate most physical suffering, not all the time. But for an ALS, a Lou Gehrig's patient, for example, most Lou Gehrig's patients don't die suffocating, because we can support them to have a peaceful and comfortable death without a feeling of shortness of breath, for example. So I think oftentimes there's a misconception that there's going to be horrible physical suffering. But if we have actual delivery of palliative care to all people, that should really be not much of an issue. Unfortunately, very rarely there are some refractory physical suffering, and that kind of ties into an ethical issue that was raised earlier today about the principle of double effect, which in those rare circumstances, for example, in my experience, there are just a handful of cases where there's been pain that a human being is experiencing that despite all our efforts medically, delivering medicines directly to the spinal fluid, all kinds of interventions that we can think of, people still have horrible physical suffering. In those cases, we render someone chemically comatose, not to the level that we instantly kill them. It's like the same level as they would be in an operation where they're not aware that their body is being cut open. So it's that level of consciousness. Of course, if we're not giving them artificial nutrition and hydration, while they're unconscious, they will eventually get dehydrated and die. And so that's an example of something called the principle of double effect. The primary intent is to relieve suffering by rendering them unconscious so they're unaware of their physical suffering, but we are completely aware as a secondary unintended consequence with absolute certainty they will eventually get dehydrated and die if their underlying disease doesn't cause them to die first. So that's an ethical and a religious issue that people have to think through. But in our society, from a legal perspective, that's legal in all 50 states, that people aren't left physically suffering. And in the worst case, we can render them unconscious and unaware of that suffering. Apart from the physical suffering, which I'm fairly confident we can control, there's what some people would call existential suffering. Some of that is actually because of depression, and that's under-recognized and under-treated in our society. But again, if people are getting good health care and good palliative care, oftentimes that can be treated and there can be dramatic improvements in people's psychological suffering with appropriate medications and counseling and interdisciplinary support, addressing their spiritual suffering, etc. Once someone actually gives them some time and puts a little effort into changing that circumstance. There are some people who still say, I'm not physically suffering, but I'm not having quality of life, and they're not depressed as best we can tell, or antidepressants didn't help them, and they just say they don't want to live. Again, legally in our society, again, there's still ethical and religious issues about this. Everyone, the Supreme Court has ruled that everyone has there's a principle of bodily integrity, that we can control what is done to our bodies, and that's what underpins in the medical terminology, withholding or withdrawing support. So if someone has a horrible illness where one of these locked-in syndromes where their brain is still alive and they're still understanding everything, but they can't interact with the world, if they had an advanced directive in place, they may say, if I get a life-threatening infection like a pneumonia, you can control whether an antibiotic is put into your body. And so you have some control over the situation and you're letting a natural process, some people would argue, play out, because you are not to maintain your body without quality of life does not make sense. And so there are legal options in our society. Again, there are tremendous spiritual, ethical, and religious issues associated with that. But so the bottom line is there are some control even in those circumstances. And the physical suffering I'm not really so worried about if everyone really has true access to palliative medicine and palliative care.
This is a question specifically addressed to Rabbi Brenner, though I suspect the panel in general might want to speak to it. Can you say more about your statement, Judaism doesn't believe in death?
Well, I mean, it was somewhat jocular, but not completely. There's certainly a very strong tradition in Judaism that speaks about the afterlife. And to put the question in context, I said people always ask me if Judaism believes in an afterlife, and I always say Judaism doesn't believe in death. But what that means really goes back to what I said earlier, which is that that once we go through that excruciating work that we need to do in order to come to terms with the death of someone with whom we've been close, there really is a sense of having their presence be palpable. We are often not trained to pick up on that. Sometimes that in order to sort of be congruent with Western understanding, we ignore the surprising things that might happen that indicate. I mean, I hear story after story about flowers blooming out of season, or just all kinds of strange coincidences, butterflies gathering at funerals. I mean, I hear these stories all the time, and I suspect you all do as well. We don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. And so being open to the possibility, I mean, I feel like a bit of a broken record, but being open to the possibility of separate realities that are not just limited by our understanding of ourselves as physical beings, I think really opens up possibilities for healing that are way beyond what we might expect from our limited understanding.
I'm going to read this question, but then I'd like to broaden it. And it may, in fact, tie in with the question of whether Judaism believes in death. The question as written is, how can a son comfort an aging father who's gone through multiple medical procedures and speaks about his fear of death and dying, and how can the son be helped to enable him to be strong and of assistance to his father? Let's talk about children and parents in general. How do children help their parents and themselves to cope with what is still probably the most common intimate loss that people first endure in their lives? General thoughts? Anyone on the panel?
My dad died a slow and painful death. And in the times that we were able to speak, the deepest thing I think that he wanted to know is that he would be remembered. That's the first thing. Will I be present? Will my name be spoken at events in the family? And I think as I watched myself and my mom and my siblings gather around this really awful a process of, I have to say, sometimes quite inept medical care. We didn't speak about this today, but present company accepted, I'm positive. Sometimes physicians are just obtuse and not cognizant of the deep, wrenching holiness that's happening in hospital rooms and convalescent homes and hospices that aren't run right with the right kind of consciousness. So I think the main thing that we offered my dad was just to gather around and to take pictures and to bring pictures. I brought drawings from my children, and we decorated his room with it. And he felt just surrounded by the love and the joy and the beauty of family. So from my personal experience out to other people, I would say, as I said earlier today, if you want to help anyone die, let's say, and it's very difficult when you talk to a parent because of the all of the unspoken and unresolved things, I think even in the best relationships, you have to find out how the person wants to die. You have to read what's going on inside of you, what's happening in you. And I don't have an answer, as much as you heard me say many times today, I have an approach. And that's to be existentially true, to understand the depth of one's own thoughts and feelings as much as one can, come close to the deepest thoughts and feelings of the other, shower a person with intimacy and love and goodness, try to work out things that can't be worked out, and things that can't be worked out, you'll be working on the rest of your life.
One of the best classes that I took in rabbinical schools with medical students, and the first exercise they had us do was imagine your death. They were trying to bring us closer together to work as a team as future chaplains and future doctors, and that was a wonderful exercise to do, and I think it's a very difficult conversation to have, but this whole issue of control and anxiety is probably the most pressing thing when we are faced with this crisis. I think that Judaism got it right when it doesn't focus so much on what is death or what is the afterlife. I don't know if this is grammatically true or not, but in the Bible, the ancient Israelite afterworld was called Sheol. And someone said to me, that comes from the verb She'elah, the question. They said, the afterlife is just a big question mark. It's just a big mystery. So many other ancient religions told you exactly what was going to happen. You were going to cross the river Styx if you were in Egypt, and that's why you had to add all your boats. You had to be buried with your boats and your slaves and all your money so you could use it all in the afterworld. And every other ancient religion could tell you exactly what it was. And Judaism very bravely and boldly said, we don't know. But that leads to anxiety because people want to know. You can't. It's the one thing you can't rehearse for. You can't practice how you're going to go through that final process, and so it's this big mystery. But I think that's much more honest. And if we can take some kind of control by having these conversations, I think it relieves a lot of the anxiety that we have. If someone says, you know, I think I'd like to die at home. I think I'd like to talk to this person. I think I would like to do this. To give us some measure of control over the end of our life, I think would make people feel a lot more comfortable.
We can't rehearse for it, but we can wonder about it. And we can have discussions of the kinds of things we wonder about. And so I think that by discussing there are various strains, certainly in the Zohar, that talks about a very specific understanding of what the afterlife is. Do I believe in it? I have no idea. But I do know that when I talk about it with people, it opens up possibility and it brings hope. I think that with regard to children and parents, there's always real challenges. I mean, I remember when my father died, and my daughter and I tried to be there as much as we could, but he wouldn't talk about any of the deeper things that I would have loved to have talked about. And it wasn't really my role to force him to talk about it. So I think knowing what's possible and trying to show up to the fullest extent that you can, really knowing, you know, da lifnei miata omei, knowing before whom you're standing. And with real reverence and respect, and then, as has been said, saving some of the work for later.
I'm going to tell you something, the source of a teaching that I have actually at the beginning of my book with being at the bedside of someone who was dying of cancer. And I just tell the story in the book, but I want to tell you where I got it from. Each year on the High Holidays, we talk about the death of Rabbi Hananya ben Turagion, the rabbis, one of the great rabbis of the Hadrianic persecutions, who died, and he was wrapped up in a Torah scroll and set on fire. And we read how his students say to him, "What do you see?" And he says, "The parchment is burning, but the letters are ascending to heaven." Right? It's a powerful story. And we read it in the Martyrology on Yom Kippur. And I remember many years ago reading Elie Wiesel talking about that story. And he said, "I always wondered, the poor guy is burning to death, and they're pestering him with questions. Why can't they leave him alone to have a certain dignity at the moment that he's dying?" And his answer was, because what was the greatest honor they could pay to him? To let him know that he was still their teacher. And how do you let someone know that he's your teacher? You ask them a question. And I remembered that. I read it years ago. I remembered that. And when I was at the bedside of this guy who was dying, what I said to him was, "At this moment, for your children and for your grandchildren, you're their teacher. They'll never forget what you tell them as you're dying. They'll never forget how you die." And to give someone power at that moment, when you feel very powerless, can be very healing, because you're emphasizing not just that people will remember your life, but they'll remember what you say right now. And it's very important how you talk to your children and grandchildren right now. On the one hand, you might think that's putting too much of a burden on somebody who's already coping with dying. But for most people, what you want to know is that you still have an influence in the world around you, especially for the people that you care about. A lot of the questions, now moving to the questions, a lot of the questions were, do you honor the wishes of a parent after they die? If you don't want to, or it's against Jewish law, what if they ask to be cremated and you know that it's against Jewish law to be cremated? Are you permitted to bury them? I'll leave it at that. Tell me how you all feel about that.
I mean, as a
Reform-ordained rabbi who grew up conservative, studied in Orthodox Yeshiva, and has a congregation that's called Traditional Progressive, which is purposefully ambiguous and expresses a kind of ambivalence, certainly. I don't work in an halakhic environment, and I'll go back to the things I tried to teach today. I'm going to repeat it simply because I want to leave you with a takeaway. My job is not to be the enforcer of the tradition. That's some other rabbi's job. It's not mine. The tradition is wise. As Mordechai Kaplan says, it has a voice. It doesn't have a veto. It's not dispositive of the situation. So my question is, if a family says, we're going to cremate, will you officiate? My question is my choice at that point to show the repugnance of the tradition and then I'm the one who's supposed to show that to this family? Or am I supposed to say, well, it's not what the tradition says, and here's why, but if you've made that decision, my job is to help you. My job is to create a ceremony for you.
What if the deceased wants to be cremated, but the family doesn't want to?
I've been in situations personally where if I follow my rules, which is read myself, I don't like the idea, I've got to be clear about that. Read the family. Typically, in my experience, the family's divided. One says, look, that's what Dad wanted. He died. Right. He wants, who are we to say, oh, Dad, we want you to do it our way. There's maybe a newly Orthodox Jew in the family with a Chabad rabbi who's, is making his will known. Every family is so different. Every situation is so different that if I read myself, read the family, I call read the room, and there's five different opinions in the room, and I read the tradition, I don't have an answer going in. I have an approach going in, and the main thing that I try to do is calm people down, try to have them find that what's happening within their own soul and bring that family to some kind of consensus where they both honor the tradition, honor the deceased, honor their own senses, and move towards something. So this is probably one of the anxieties that one has when one lives in a post-halakhic world. If you're firmly ensconced in the halakhic world, the world where the Jewish law is dispositive, there are no questions. You say, go call a reform rabbi. Right? In the world that I live, where I have great honor for the tradition. The tradition is wise. It guides my life. Sometimes when it's my will versus the tradition wins. Because I've decided to be subservient to the tradition. But as a rabbi who serves people, I honestly don't know what my answer is going to be until I've done the spiritual work that I have to do and hopefully guided them wisely in the spiritual work that they have to do.
Back to
Can't hear you.
Can you hear me better now?
Closer and louder.
I think the problem may be the... I can't get any closer.
Okay.
Try his.
I think there's... Yeah. I keep going back to the Yom Kippur liturgy, which begins with a ritual in which we let go of vows. And so I think that my tendency would be to have people really look at the vows they make and be lenient and forgiving of themselves if they want to let go of something. A lot of times we say things, and I believe I believe there is something that releases people from obligations if they're made under duress.
Yes, there is. You mean in terms of promising we will cremate you?
Yeah, I swear I'll marry him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole long Talmudic discussion about that. Right. Yeah. What would you do?
I would just say that I don't have my red lines, I guess, very clearly. It always happens to me when the case comes before me. I just had a recent situation where someone asked me to do a funeral that was going to take place a month after the person died. Of course, my initial reaction was, we Jews don't do that. We try and bury as soon as possible. I've heard waiting 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, even a week. But this family wanted to wait a month. They had a lot of people who couldn't come in, and they could only come in at that particular time, and that was their way of showing honor to the deceased person. They had no connection to any other rabbi. They barely had a connection to me. So my option was to send them off right to some other rabbi who they had no connection with whatsoever, or to kind of swallow my initial reaction and say that in the spirit of the law, they are trying to bring honor to the deceased according to the letter of the law. They're not following.
Yeah, this is a constant, and you get people on both sides of this, right? If you say, I will bend the tradition infinitely, then the tradition has no content. If, on the other hand, you say, I won't bend the tradition at all, then you're obviously not listening to the person in front of you. And as you've heard, everybody has different lines. So, for example, I have officiated at services if someone has already been cremated, but I won't officiate at a service where someone is going to be cremated, and I won't have the urn there, or so on and so forth. And I would try very, very hard to get that family to disregard the person's wishes. But that's, you know, there's... it's tough, as you heard, and that's that is one part of the question. The second part of the question, actually, which Rabbi Finley brought up in his response, but maybe is worth more exploration, is what if a parent has a medical directive that says DNR, do not resuscitate, but the other parent doesn't want to honor it? We have the particular here, and in this particular case, the disease is advanced Parkinson's and dementia. The patient is beginning to lose swallowing and will likely aspirate at some point. Should the patient receive breathing tube nourishment? I'm going to give the particulars for Dr. Thomas's response. Patient currently has almost no quality of life, confined to wheelchair, incontinent, can't feel himself, can't talk, unclear whether he's cognizant of the situation. Do you have any comments to make about the specifics of the situation? Then we can talk about the conflict in the family.
The specifics of the medical situation sound pretty dire, so it sounds like it turns out what it depends on what the advance directive says. If the, from an ethical and legal point, I guess legal first and ethical point, if the specific clinical scenario is stated in an advance directive, even if the spouse wants something different, that legal paper actually has some weight. What practically would be done in a hospital environment is to try to initially talk about that, saying this specific situation is covered, your spouse wanted this, that's what we legally have to follow. And the surrogate decision maker, if there had been one appointed, shouldn't actually be able to trump that if it's exactly right. The problem in the real world is oftentimes in advance directives, the clinical situation isn't exactly what someone says. Most living wills or advanced directives may say something like, if I'm in a persistent vegetative state, I don't want artificial nutrition and hydration. But, for example, somebody with Parkinson's who's having trouble swallowing and who may get a pneumonia very quickly, that wasn't probably explicitly written out in the document. Therefore, the decision-making power goes to the surrogate decision-maker if there was one appointed. If there was nobody appointed and there's a conflict in the family, again, what's practically done is you have a family conference and try to get family consensus. If that doesn't work, then there's every healthcare institution has an ethics committee that would meet and would make a recommendation, and they would start carrying that out. And then families have the right to go to court. And that's how the steps would go in the real world. So I'll leave some of the other ethicals.
I would ask a question of the partner who doesn't want to let the DNR stand. I would ask them, are you afraid of death? That is, of his dying. Do you think that what's going to happen to him is bad? Or are you afraid of being without him? If what you're afraid of is being without him, I certainly understand, but it still may be better for him to do this. If you're afraid of death, then maybe that's something that you should talk to a rabbi about or someone else about, because it's going to happen to all of us. So the question is, why, what's the motivation? And see if the person can be reflective of what it is that they're feeling. It may be that what they don't want is the responsibility for feeling like they allowed this to happen. And you may be able to relieve them of that if through the advance directive, or you may talk to the doctor who can say, look, this is the advance directive, it's really not your choice. And they may kick and scream but be glad to be relieved of that responsibility. So it's complicated.
Well, this is certainly a time for pastoral or therapeutic intervention. Yeah. I mean, this is an early stage of grieving where you refuse to let go. And so there's a lot of, I mean, there's just a lot of work that can come, as you said, if someone can begin to be self-reflective, it may be easier to make that next step and honor the directive.
All right, so panel, last comments. What would you say is the most important lesson that you can, the question was, why is Jewish tradition against cremation? For two reasons, I'll just give them very quickly. One is because your body doesn't belong to you. It was given to you by God, and therefore you don't have the right to destroy it. A natural process can take it, but you don't have a right to burn it up, right? Because it's not yours. It's God's. God gave it to you. God claims it back. And the second reason that many people are against cremation is in the aftermath of the Holocaust, to willingly burn a Jewish body just seems, I'll use my own word, unthinkable. But for many Jews, it's not. Okay. What, in a sentence or two, what are the most important things that you have to say to people here, all of whom, as we all will confront not only the death of people who are close to them, but their own death? What single message? And I'm going to start with Dr. Thomas, Rabbi Sella, Rabbi Brenner, and then Rabbi Findley.
I would say actually dealing with our own deaths sooner than later actually enhances life.
Have the conversation now. Don't wait until the moment of crisis where you can't think straight, where you're just so overcome with a flood of emotions and you will regret whichever way, even if it ends up being the right decision in your head or the wrong, you're just feeling so torn because you're having to make such a pressure decision. Have the conversation now, even if it doesn't seem like it's going to be relevant for years and years. Have the conversations now.
The thing that comes to me is the thing that really helped me the most when I lost my mother and sister when I was quite a bit younger. And I actually was doing yoga and had this sense of really understanding for the first time what the Shema was about, and really knowing that all the worlds are one and that I hadn't lost them and that God was present. And that it's all a mystery, and so learning to dance in the presence of mystery is really the challenge of being a human.
I have a thought I can't get out of my head, so I hope it's responsive. When Rabbi Brenner said we don't believe in death, people ask me what I believe in. Do you believe in this? Do you believe in that? There's a semantic problem, because when sometimes people say, do you believe in something? Like, do you believe in God? I mean, do you believe in the factual existence of? So belief is the stating of a reality that cannot be proved empirically. So the Hebrew word la'amin can be used that way from the medievals, but more etymologically, it has a sense of trust or reliability. So I don't say, what do I believe in? I say, to what am I loyal? Emunah can also have a sense of loyalty. In German, the word belief, which is used, its origin is beliebt, which means beloved. What do I love, and what am I loyal to? So in this way, I am loyal to living. I love the idea of living a life of truth, integrity, honesty, presence, love, beauty, and so forth. That's the way I want to live. Those are the virtues that I pray that I am, to which I'm the most deeply loyal. So when I'm present to a dying person, a bereaved family, when I face my own death, I want to live the kind of life that when I die, I'm going to die like I live. I want to die so that my family, people know that I love them. I want to die courageously. I want to die with nobility. All the ways that I want to live is how I want to die. And the people that I work with, I hope that they can live a life of virtue, and die a virtuous and beautiful death.
So rather than end with my own words, I'm going to end with the words that we end the service with, but everybody's always putting their talus away and walking out and not paying attention to it. But it's actually maybe the most beautiful line in the entire service. It's the end of the Adon Olam. V'im ruchi gviati, Adonai li v'lo ira. And if my soul should pass away, God is with me, and I will not be afraid.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.